Even though we're looking at Hebrews chapter 9, particularly verse 22, we're going to be reading this entire section beginning with verse 22 through the end of the chapter, where the writer to the Hebrews says, "Indeed, under the law, almost everything is purified with blood, and without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. Thus it was necessary for the copies of heavenly things to be purified with these rites, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ has entered into the holy places, made with hands which are copies of true things, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. Nor was it to offer himself repeatedly as the high priest enters the holy places every year with blood not his own, for then he would have had to suffer repeatedly since the foundation of the world. But as it is, he has appeared once for all at the end of the ages to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And just as it is appointed for man to die once, and after that comes the judgment, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who eagerly are waiting for him." I have taken the opportunity to redress some of the issues that we have covered in this lengthy exposition of Romans. And before continuing on, I had paused to reassess what we had to say about the doctrine of justification by faith alone, a central theme in the Epistle to the Romans, and to once again look at the controversial group known as the Federal Vision. For almost a decade now, the Reformed churches, particularly in North America, have been embroiled in a controversy that dates back a few decades prior to this. The Federal Vision was birthed in 2002, but really it owes its origin to a theological professor at Westminster Seminary when I was there by the name of Norman Shepherd. Norman Shepherd began to teach that the real Reformed doctrine had been confused with the Lutheran one. The Lutherans taught justification by faith alone. And Shepherd felt that this was somehow lacking in a proper emphasis, and so he began to teach that we are justified by a certain kind of faith and the works that accompany it. Well, this got him into a lot of trouble. And so he began to speak differently, not because his beliefs had changed, but because he was going to try to qualify what he meant by justification by faith plus works. And so he began to say, we are justified by covenantal faithfulness. That is, the quality of your faith in the final analysis is going to be the determining factor in whether or not you are really justified. Now, on the heels of Shepherd's teaching, we were also introduced to what is known as the New Perspective on Paul. This was primarily something that was the efforts of three men, E.P. Sanders, a Jewish scholar, and James Dunn, and more importantly, for the purposes of our analysis, the Bishop of Durham, N.T. Wright. The New Perspective on Paul basically taught that you get in by grace, you get into the covenant by grace, but you sustain your covenantal status by faithfulness. And that there are two justifications. There is your initial justification, but that may not suffice. Because in the final analysis, it's the final justification in which your whole life is taken into purview, and based upon that, You will be declared righteous on the last day. So these elements combined to give us what we now know as the federal vision. In the federal vision, they share with Norman Shepherd and N.T. Wright the stress that justifying faith has this characteristic feature of faithfulness. In fact, some of Shepherd's disciples have said, matter-of-factly, that the Reformation slogan of justification by faith alone is misleading because it gives you the impression that simple faith in Christ secures for you forever the favor of God. It came as no surprise to discover that Norman Shepherd and many of his followers in the Federal Vision rejected out of hand two critical Reformed doctrines. One, they rejected the classical understanding of the doctrine of the covenant works. Now, the covenant of works, you will remember, according to Reformed theology, God established a covenant with Adam in the garden. And based upon his obedience to the command, he would fulfill the obligations God laid upon him in order to secure for himself and his posterity divine favor. Adam failed. He broke the covenant. And Christ, who is called the second or last Adam, fulfills that covenant. Now, in order to fulfill it, what does he have to do? He has to live a perfect life of obedience and thereby render to God, in his obedience, satisfaction for the broken law by becoming a substitute penalty to bear the penalty of the broken law. We speak of the passive and active obedience of Christ. By his passive obedience, we mean that he underwent the punishment we were due by suffering the penalty of the broken law. But equally important is that by his active obedience, he fulfills the covenant, and so his righteousness of his life is credited to us. Now, why would they reject those two doctrines? Well, they do it for this reason. They reject them because if that is the basis for your acceptance with God, then your individual covenant faithfulness cannot play a part in it. I have a quote on the front of your bulletin from the great Dutch Reformed theologian Herman Bavinck. And the seriousness of what's at stake here was properly captured by him. He said this, quote, "This righteousness of Christ is so perfect and adequate that it requires no completion or supplementation of our own. As a matter of fact, it can in no way be increased or amplified by us, for it is an organic whole. Just as the law is a whole, so that whoever would keep it entirely but should stumble at just one commandment would be guilty of it all," so says James 2:10. "So too, the righteousness which satisfied the demands of the law is a perfect whole and unity, like the seamless robe of Jesus woven from top throughout." He's alluding to John 19:23. "This righteousness," he says, "has not been put together from pieces or fragments. You either have all of it or none of it. We cannot get part of it and fill in the rest ourselves." See, the Federal Vision teaches, yes, Christ has done this for you, but your continual faithfulness is a determining factor in whether or not you will be declared just on the last day. The other thing the Federal Visionists teach is that there is no such thing as an invisible and visible church. The church is composed of all who are in union with Christ via baptism. If you have been baptized either as an infant or as an adult, you are ipso facto a member of the covenant. And your contribution to that covenant standing is contingent upon your ongoing faithfulness or obedience. You may start out in covenant with Christ and have all of the blessings that He has secured for you, but you could lose them all. In fact, they create two kinds of election. There are those who have been decreed by God to be elect, and we don't know who those are. That's only known to God. But there's another category of election. Those who are covenantally elect. That is, you join the church, you undergo baptism, you're one of the elect. Hypothetically. Covenantally, you're elect. And you may have all of the blessings that Christ has secured for you, including the forgiveness of your sins. But this is only temporary. It's like the small print you read in your insurance policy, in which it says, "will only be paid if struck by lightning at 3 o'clock in the morning." Didn't see that part. The Federal Visionists teach that there is such a thing as temporal forgiveness of sins. Imagine it now. Let's look at this in some detail. On what basis does God forgive sin? What does our text tell us? That without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. Now, a couple of things you need to note about the passage we just read in Hebrews 9:22. Notice that the writer says at the beginning that nearly everything, he says, is cleansed with blood. Very important little word there. Nearly. Why is that? Well, because when you go through your Old Testament, in Leviticus and Numbers especially, you'll find out that purification was sometimes had by water. Things were purified by water. Sometimes they were purified by fire. Most of the time it was by blood, but there were other means to bring about purification. But at the end of that verse, without any qualifications, he says, without the shedding of blood, however, there is no forgiveness. Now you and I, sometimes by virtue of the fact that we were not reared in a society that the Jews understood, may have a difficult time with concepts such as blood sacrifices. When God instituted the covenant with Moses, it was ratified by the shedding of blood. Now, two things you should note when this expression, shedding of blood, comes up. One, the emphasis upon blood means life. But more importantly, that word shed means its life taken. It's not like the sheep had a heart attack and started hemorrhaging blood through its nose, and the Israelites said, "Oh, look, a dead animal, we can use this." No, it was just the opposite. You read your Old Testament and you discover that the Levites had to slay the animal. There was an emphasis upon the fact that the animal's life is taken violently. Now, to our squeamish stomachs, we may not see the significance of why some harmless animal life has to be shed to atone for the sins that we have committed. But this was God's object lesson in teaching the Israelites what sin was. There is no forgiveness of sin without this violent act of shedding blood. Without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. Now, if you read through the Epistle to the Hebrews, you will discover that this man, and by the way, we read in the Belgic Confession where it says the Apostle Paul was the author of it, the book of Hebrews nowhere claims to be written by Paul. There is no manuscript that says the Apostle Paul to the Hebrews. The early church didn't know who wrote it. Now, he may have written it, but there is no textual evidence where Paul's name is attached to it. So you will hear me say things like, the writer to the Hebrews, because we are just speculating as to who wrote it. But whoever did write it knew his Old Testament backwards and forwards. And he says that the blood of bulls and goats, although they foreshadowed the future work of Christ, could in no way take away sins. And his argument is rather airtight, because it has to be done over and over and over again. There is an annual reminder. The people were visually reminded about the seriousness of sin, because this was something that had to be done annually. Now, the other thing they had to learn was the fact that only certain people could act in the capacity as a priest. You could not just say, I'm going to do this myself. I think, I think I ought to go out in the backyard and I'll get the sheep and I'll cut its throat and I'll offer up this bloody sacrifice to God. Unacceptable, unacceptable. You are not approved to do that. Only the house of Levi can do that, and not just any priest, but the great high priest. He and he only can go into this place called the Holy of Holies with great fear and trepidation. Because if something went wrong, if he missed something, he could be slain on the spot. Did you know that the Israelites were instructed that the high priest is to have bells on his garments so that they can hear him moving? And a rope is to be attached to his waist. Why is that? If he dies, no one's going in there. You can't do that. God took this seriously. So you have to drag him out. No, the blood of bulls and goats could never do this. They were pictures, types, as we call them, that foreshadowed the reality of Christ doing something that they only could foreshadow. Now, here in this passage, we see the dimensions of what has been known as penal substitutionary doctrine of the atonement. Christ is dying a criminal death. He is being punished by God in the place of sinners. The atonement is penal. That is, he is offering himself up in the place of criminals, sinners, who have violated God's commands and are subject to the penalty of the broken law. All of us have sinned in word, thought, and deed, by commission as well as omission, and there is no health in us. Now, Christ does something. He comes as a great high priest, as a mediator. We have a great high priest over the house of God who has entered into heavens itself after having made purification. He cleanses all things. But more importantly, he secures for us this promised forgiveness. What is interesting about this is where the text says, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. And behind that image of shedding, Jesus captures it with these words, his blood of the covenant, which we celebrate with the Lord's Supper. In Matthew 26:28, Jesus said, this is my blood of the covenant, which is what? Poured out. Poured out. He is doing something. Not only is he having something done to him, he is suffering the eternal curse of God against sin. But he is pouring out his life. Now, how does that affect the subject we're talking about this morning? We ask the question, how does God forgive sin? Only through the atonement of Christ. So Christ secures for some people temporary forgiveness. That is, they start out with their sins forgiven temporarily, but at some point down the road, through negligence, covenant unfaithfulness, they lose that forgiveness and they perish. Now, one of two things has to happen. Either God is guilty of what is known as double jeopardy. What is that? What is double jeopardy? And I'm not talking about the game show. Double jeopardy means that an offense is punished twice. So Christ bears the penalty for these people's sins, but it's only temporary, so they must bear the penalty again. Or, if you don't go that route, you say something like this. Well, you see, Christ died for their sins up to a certain point, and then they pay for the rest of them. Now, either way, what does this do to the atonement of Christ? Christ dies for people. That is, he offers himself up as a vicarious substitute for people that are going to end up damned. What does that do to the atonement? It's meaningless. He dies for no purpose at all. I'm going to lay my life down for my sheep, but eventually not all of them are going to make it. I'm going to die for my sheep, and I'm going to lose some of them. Wait a minute. Didn't Jesus say, all that the Father has given me, I will lose none of them? How can we possibly be joined to Christ in any significant sense and end up being lost? This is the consequences of what the federal vision leaves us with. They leave us with an Arminianized gospel, which makes our justification contingent upon something we do. It's not the faith that looks to Christ that justifies us, but the duration of our faith. I could not tell you, if I was a federal visionist sympathizer, that I'm sure that you are justified before God. You might be. I don't know. Now, if you've been baptized, I can tell you this much. You have forgiveness, at least for the time being. It might not last. I've told you this before. If I believe this, I would set about killing as many of you as I could right now. Why run the risk of you winding up in hell? Because maybe tomorrow something's going to go wrong. So all of you that I really liked, if I didn't like you, I'd leave you alone. But if I really liked you, you better look out. Because I can shoot. I mean, when they arrest me, I said, huh, I saved their eternal soul. Isn't that the kind of reasoning that you have to have if there's such a thing as temporary forgiveness of sins that could be lost? The federal vision is not a tempest in a teapot. It is a serious error that is afflicting our Reformed churches. All down through the history of the Reformed churches, we have had to deal with all kinds of errors. This one is just simply a resurgence of two of them. As I identify them in the opening notes, an Amaraldianism, which says there is a hypothetical nature to the atonement, and a more explicit Arminianism, which says, in effect, that those for whom Christ died will end up perishing. Thankfully, our Reformed confessions deny this. I challenge you to do something for me. Read what I've had to say here about the federal visionists, and then get out the Psalter or the little handbook in the back and read the Canons of Dort's Rejection of Errors. And you will see that every single error that the federal visionists are advocating was condemned by our Reformed forefathers. Read the Westminster Standards. Read the Heidelberg Catechism. Read the Belgic Confession. Our Reformed forefathers saw this and condemned it. May God grant wisdom to our churches to do likewise. As the elders and deacons come forward now, would you prepare to remember the Lord Jesus as he is displayed?